Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with AIB, offering Irish businesses practical knowledge and support to become more sustainable. AIB, for the life you're after.
Now, in the Green Scene today, the loss of biodiversity in key protected areas, but first the degradation of soil, which will impact on the nutritional value of our food. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman, Director of Science for Society at Research Ireland. Ruth, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
So it's not just in little old Ireland. Everywhere, soil is degrading. Why?
So soil is degrading for lots of different reasons. I mean, erosion is one reason. Soil, you know, fertile soil can just be washed away. But we're also seeing a loss of organic matter in soil because soil is made of minerals. It's made of, there's actually more microbes in a teaspoon of soil than there are people on Earth. It's a hugely dense piece of life. And there could be 10,000 species in that one teaspoon. So obviously you can lose those with pesticides and with pollution that's going into the soil. And we're also seeing soil that's becoming salty and compacted. So there's lots of different reasons why we lose soil. And actually, we're losing about 24 billion tons of soil every year. And what scientists estimate is about 25% of all the fertile soil we had on Earth is gone. So we do need to keep an eye on this, because if we keep going at this rate, 95% will be gone
now,
by 2050.
You know, when we're just planting intensely, we're planting crops. And there used to be crop rotation. That was the thing.
Yeah.
Potatoes this year, wheat next year, whatever it might be. I mean, to what extent does the food that is grown in these areas actually deplete the soil itself?
Well, it certainly can, and that's because of things like nitrogen and carbon. So in that soil rotation, you're putting in plants that are fixing nitrogen into the soil, and then the next year you can put in plants that are going to use that nitrogen. But it is also about the biodiversity in the soil, because particularly fungi that live in the soil, they are responsible for keeping water in the soil, which is essential, but they also almost expand the root area of plants by growing and attaching to the roots of plants. So all of these things are really, really important. And of course, soil is critical for all of us because it's where most of our food comes from. 95% of our food is dependent on soil. So you know, we really need to be cautious about protecting soil for ourselves and for future generations. And we're also conscious that soil is now producing less nutrient-dense food. So things like calcium, iron, phosphorus, we see that fruit and vegetables nowadays have much less of those minerals in them, maybe up to 20% less than they had only 50 years ago.
Now, on flooding plains, for instance, we're told that the silt that comes down from the river and then causes the flood actually is good for growing on those areas.
Absolutely. And there are ways that soil can regenerate. And I mean, that's one of the pieces of research that was discussed this week, which was really about a very novel biodiversity solution to think about soil, because it can be a little bit depressing when we think about the state of the place. But this is a really, really interesting study which happened in Mount St. Helens in Washington State, and it erupted in 1980. And what happened when it erupted was a whole part of the volcano, that the southern side was completely covered in ash, and that ash had no carbon in it. It had no nitrogen.
No microbes.
Completely kind of dead zone. And what researchers did, and it's amazing, they did this 20 years ago, they took some gophers who lived in a camp, sort of an area on the other side of the volcano, and they airlifted them into fenced off areas, and they put one gopher per fenced off area.
Yeah.
And they left the gopher there for 24 hours.
And then, just a day.
And then they picked them up, they recaptured them, and they took them back to where they had been before. And what was amazing was that nearly four decades later, we can still see the impact of those gophers. And what they did was, even 6 years later, when they went back and looked at the areas where these gophers had been, there was 40,000 different plant species growing where these gophers had been, compared to still desert areas where they had not been. So what the gophers, of course, had done is they are master diggers. I mean, a bit like the beavers, we call them ecosystem engineers because they get in and dig. But of course, they also had things attached to their fur. They probably had spores. They might have had those very important fungi that we talked about.
And they pooed.
So they did all of this. And particularly the fungi that they brought created an environment where really soil could be recreated and plants and life.
Who was the genius who did not, you know, could not have anticipated that 40 years later there'd be this magnificent result?
Isn't it wonderful that we have scientists that try these things so we can learn?
Now, biodiversity loss in protected areas, these are areas where actually the job is to protect the biodiversity in the areas, and these are losing biodiversity faster than areas that are not protected.
I know, it seems counterintuitive. And we've talked before about this goal that came from COP. It came from COP28, and that was that countries would commit to protecting 30% of the land and sea area on Earth, kind of for wildlife, for biodiversity. And at the moment, you know, we just had COP16, which was specifically focused on biodiversity in Colombia. And this is where this research was presented, because it was a bit of a warning call that we can't just take that 30% by 2030 for granted. And this was research from the Natural History Museum in London, and it looked at how intact biodiversity is in protected areas. And it particularly focused on the most biodiverse areas on Earth. So when we look at these indices of biodiversity, 22% of the Earth is considered highly biodiverse. So this includes areas like the Amazon Basin, the Congo Basin, and you know, 90% of biodiversity, up to 90%, could be contained in these areas. So they're absolutely critical for humanity.
And how many of those are actually protected?
So only about 22% of those areas are protected. So that was really the comparison. When you look at those really biodiverse areas and you compare the protected areas versus the non-protected areas, and what they actually found is the protected areas are losing slightly more biodiversity than the unprotected areas. So the protected areas had lost about 1.9 percentage points of biodiversity, but the protected areas had lost 2.1 percentage points.
How do they go about measuring this? Because when you're talking about biodiversity, I mean, we were talking about earlier microbes and fungi and all of this. Yeah. So how do you actually go about measuring all of that stuff?
It's incredibly difficult, but scientists now use lots of different methods to do it. So, I mean, they use things like eDNA, environmental DNA sampling. That'll give us a sense of how biodiverse an area is. And of course, there's monitoring going on in these areas of how many sightings you get of particular animals and plants. But of course, this is a concern, because what it tells us is just designating an area as a protected area is not enough. So firstly, we do need to monitor, because your question's a very good one. How can we measure what's going on if we don't know? So we need much better monitoring for these protected areas. But we will also probably need much more specific interventions. And a good example here is our own national parks, you know, many of which are not fenced off. And, you know, they are open to grazing animals, for example. So you know, you can protect, you can designate an area as protected, but it may not end up actually...
And the other thing is, there might be an area that's designated to protect one particular species, and half a dozen others will die off.
That is true. And of course, there may be a bias here in that the most fragile areas might have been the first to be protected, so they may already have been suffering. I mean, we know, for example, in Australia, many of the areas that they protected were subjected to those awful wildfires. So you know, kind of with best efforts, you still can't manage to protect things. But what we're also seeing is an overlap between biodiversity and development for energy. So we're seeing in places like the Congo and the Amazon, there's mining and for rare earth elements, for renewable energy. And these are overlapping with the areas that we want to, the designated areas to protect. I mean, here we have, you know, potential to put huge amounts of wind farms off our east coast, which is also a sensitive area. So how do we find the areas where we can protect, but where we can also then, you know, do these kind of developments for renewable energy?
When you're talking about putting the wind farms off Kish Bank or whatever in the Irish Sea, what is the downside? Because... There was a report, maybe even you brought it to me before, about how fish might prosper at the foundations of some of these.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we have here at the East Coast is those sandbanks, which are hugely biodiverse, sensitive areas, and many of those leases were granted many, many years ago. So there is now newer technology where we can potentially think about pushing those developments further offshore or have them as floating turbines, which have much lower impact. I mean, I think that what we see at the base of turbines, we don't know yet. There is certainly some species that may come back, but are we really going to recreate the diverse, you know, sort of grounds that we have on those sandbanks? So really what we need is to use scientific methods to find the most biodiverse areas. And then we need to think about how we protect
them. Now, we were talking about COP before and how this is kind of an interim COP. But one of the items on the agenda was compensating countries that are doing their bit, shall we say, or who are significantly under threat because of global warming. Did they reach any agreement on that?
This is the loss and damage fund. Yeah. I mean, I think at the moment all that is very much up in the air. I mean, obviously because of the recent elections in the US, but also China wasn't part of those discussions at the early stages because really of the development stage it was at when the initial idea was kind of floated. But obviously now it would make sense for China to come in under that agreement as well.
Still, is it the number, US is still the number one polluter in the world. China's number two, India maybe number three.
Well, I think the EU actually comes out at number three when you put it as a per head consumption. So,
but I mean, China is no longer a developing nation.
Yeah.
And it gets certain breaks because it is designated as such.
And that is some of the conversation that's happening at COP now. You know, do we need to revisit that? And who needs to pay into those funds to protect these areas and mitigate the carbon going into the atmosphere?
Dr. Ruth Freeman, Director of Science for Society at Research Ireland. Thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.